Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we will be discussing chapter 26 of Wuthering Heights, and then we'll be reading chapter 27. Chapter 26, the questions I asked you guys were these: how is Linton, though, do you reckon? And what did I mean by that? Why did I ask that? How is Linton, though, do you reckon? Kathy seemed quite cold towards Linton in this chapter. Why do you reckon? And how do you think Heathcliff treats Linton when it's just them together? Tecrific said, Linton is wasting away. It seems clear that he's slowly dying. Kathy is finally beginning to be suspicious of Linton and Heathcliff's machinations behind the scenes, and Heathcliff is probably treating Linton better than any other person at Wuthering Heights, not out of any real concern, but for convenience's sake, in order to easier manipulate Linton. That's my 2 cents, penny, ore, drachma, yen, you get the idea, insert your currency of choice. I'm going to stick with cents, thanks Tech. Australian cents though, please. Savvy Kid said, straight up dying, malnourished and severely abused. That's how Linton is, even if that abuse is in the form of denying him rest. I think the image of Linton that Kathy had in her mind was nourished by old love letters and her own fantasies. However, the reality of him is quite different than what she had envisioned. I think she is eager to have Wuthering Heights because she feels that this encounter is awkward. She is eager to leave Wuthering Heights because she feels that this encounter is awkward. And she is so cold to Linton because he clearly doesn't entertain or tolerate her ideas of fantasy any longer. I imagine that Heathcliff continues to be ashamed of his son, and it only worsens as his condition worsens. He has clearly been abused in some way, because Linton becomes anxious when he thinks that he heard his name being called. It seems that Linton has been conditioned by the abuse, and only begs Kathy to stay to have a break from it. Starfall said, Linton here started from his slumber in bewildered terror and asked if anyone had called his name. No, said Catherine. Unless in dreams, I cannot conceive how you managed to doze out of doors in the morning. I thought I heard my father, he gasped, glancing up to the frowning Nab above us. Are you sure nobody spoke? I never thought I would be laughing at the misery of a boy, but at this part I started chuckling. This boy is obviously being terrorized at home. He never had a good constitution or a strong will. The poor one is imagining his father in all places. Is he getting any sleep at home? Is sleep deprivation being used on him to force him to meet up with Kathy? I never understood Kathy's willingness to meet up with him. I know she doesn't have any other option to socialize, but what is he offering her? No conversation, no walking together, nothing. I think her reaction in this chapter is the normal one, especially for her age. Wasm said, I think Linton sees Kathy as an opportunity to escape Heathcliff and his anger, both by getting out of the house and getting with Kathy as Heathcliff wants them. But he has no desire beyond escape to keep her engaged. He knows he should be spending time with her, but has no interest in her as a person. It's really telling how he's treated at home that nearly mentioning his father gets him this shaken. We know from back when Lockwood met Kathy that they are related through his son, so I'm really curious to find out what pushes her to go through with it. Is it pity? It's a really strange little match-up there, Linton and Kathy. Doesn't seem to make sense from any perspective, but hey, it does seem like that's what happens, so I'm kind of curious too, like, to see how does this play forward from here? How do they get to, well, the starting point of the novel? There's only one way to settle such a curiosity, and that is to move forward, so let's do just that and read chapter 27 of Wuthering Heights. I do apologize for kind of breezing through the conversation today. It is quite late. I've just gotten in from Uber driving all night to make a little bit of money. and just walked in the door and very much like to just crash straight into bed. But I haven't done the podcast yet, of course, so here I am. And it is a bit of a longer chapter, but I don't want to split it up because it's not quite long enough for me to say it's a long chapter. It's 16 pages. So it is long-ish, but it's not like a 20 or a 30-page one. So I figured I would breeze through the comments, shorten that up a little bit, do that nice and quickly, and dive straight into reading. So here we go. 7 days glided away, everyone marking its course by the henceforth rapid alteration of Edgar Linton's state. The havoc that month had previously wrought was now emulated by the inroads of hours. Catherine would fain have deluded yet, but her own quick spirit refused to delude her. It divined in secret, and brooded on the dreadful probability, gradually ripening into certainty. She had not the heart to mention her ride when Thursday came round. I mentioned it for her, and obtained permission to order her out of doors for the library, where her father stopped a short time daily, the brief period he could bear to sit up, and his chamber had become her whole world. She grudged each moment that did not find her bending over his pillow or seated by his side. Her countenance grew wan with watching and sorrow, and my master gladly dismissed her to what he flattered himself would be a happy change of scene and society, drawing comfort from the hope that she would not now be left entirely alone after his death. He had a fixed idea, I guessed by several observations he let fall, that as his nephew resembled him in person, he would resemble him in mind, for Linton's letters bore few or no indications of his defective character, and I, through pardonable weakness, refrained from correcting the error, asking myself what good there would be in disturbing his last moments with information that he had neither power nor opportunity to turn to account. We deferred our excursion till the afternoon, a golden afternoon of August, every breath from the hills so full of life that it seemed whoever respired it, though dying, might revive. Catherine's face was just like the landscape, shadows and sunshine flitting over it in rapid succession, but the shadows rested longer, and the sunshine was more transient, and her poor little heart reproached itself for even that passing forgetfulness of its cares. We discerned Linton watching at the same spot he had selected before. My young mistress alighted and told me that, as she was resolved to stay a very little while, I had better hold the pony and remain on horseback. But I dissented. I wouldn't risk losing sight of the charge committed to me a minute, so we climbed the slope of Heath together. Master Heathcliff received us with greater animation on this occasion. Not the animation of high spirits, though, nor yet of joy. It looked more like fear. "It is late," he said, speaking short and with difficulty. "Is not your father very ill? I thought you wouldn't come." "Why won't you be candid?" cried Catherine, swallowing her greeting. "Why cannot you say at once you don't want me? It is strange, Linton, that for the second time you have brought me here on purpose, apparently to distress us both, and for no reason besides." Linton shivered and glanced at her, half supplicating, half ashamed, but his cousin's patience was so sufficient to endure this enigmatic behaviour. "My father is very ill," he said, she said. "And why am I called from his bedside? Why didn't you send to absolve me from my promise when you wished I wouldn't keep it? Come, I desired an explanation. Playing and trifling are completely banished out of my mind, and I cannot dance attendance on your affections now." "My affections," he murmured. "What are they? For heaven's sake, Catherine, don't look so angry. Despise me as much as you please. I am worthless, a cowardly wretch. I can't be scorned enough. But I am too mean for your anger. Hate my father and spare me for contempt." "Nonsense," cried Catherine in a passion. "Foolish, silly boy. And there he trembles as if I were really going to touch him. You needn't bespeak contempt, Linton. Anybody will have it spontaneously at your service. Get off, I shall return home. It is folly dragging you from the hearthstone and pretending. What do we pretend? Let go of my frock. If I pitied you for crying and looking so very frightened, you should spurn such pity. Alan, tell him how disgraceful this conduct is. Rise and don't degrade yourself into an abject reptile, don't. With streaming face and an expression of agony, Linton had thrown his nerveless frame along the ground. He seemed convulsed with exquisite terror. Oh, he sobbed, I cannot bear it. Catherine, Catherine, I am a traitor too, and I dare not tell you, but leave me and I shall be killed, dear Catherine. My life is in your hands, and you have said you loved me, and if you did, it wouldn't harm you. You will not go then, kind, sweet, good Catherine, and perhaps you will consent, and he will let me die with you. My young lady, on witnessing his intense anguish, stopped, stooped to raise him. The old feeling of indulgent tenderness overcame her vexation, and she grew thoroughly moved and alarmed. Consent to what? She asked. To stay? Tell me the meaning of this strange talk, and I will. You contradict your own words and distract me. Be calm and frank, and confess at once all the ways on your heart. You wouldn't injure me, Linton, would you? You wouldn't let an enemy hurt me, if you could prevent it. I'll believe you are a coward for yourself, but not a cowardly betrayer of your best friend. But my father threatened me, gasped the boy, clasping his attenuated fingers, and I dared him, I dread him, I dare not tell. Oh well, said Catherine, with scornful compassion, keep your secret. I'm no coward. Save yourself. I'm not afraid. Her magnanimity provoked his tears. He wept wildly, kissing her supporting hands, and yet could not summon courage to speak out. I was cogitating what the mystery might be, and determined Catherine should never suffer to benefit him or anyone else by my goodwill, when, hearing a rustle among the ling, I looked up and saw Mr. Heathcliff almost close upon us, descending the heights. He didn't cast a glance towards my companions, though they were sufficiently near for Linton's sobs to be audible. But, hailing me in the most almost hearty tone he assumed to none besides, and the sincerity of which I couldn't avoid doubting, he said, "It is something to see you so near to my house, Nelly. How are you at the Grange? Let us hear. The rumour goes," he added in a lower tone, "that Edgar Linton is on his deathbed. Perhaps they exaggerate his illness." "No, my master is dying," I replied. "It is true enough. A sad thing it will be for all of us, but a blessing for him." "How long will he last, do you think?" he asked. "I don't know," I said. "Because," he continued, looking at the two young people who were fixed under his eye, Linton appeared as if he could not venture to stir or raise his head, and Catherine could not move on his account. "Because that lad yonder seems determined to beat me, and I'd thank his uncle to be quick and go before him. Hello, has the whelp been playing that game long? I did give him some lessons about snivelling. Is he pretty lively with Mrs. Linton generally?" "Lively? No, he has shown the greatest distress," I answered. "To see him, I should say that instead of rambling with his sweetheart on the hills, he ought to be in bed under the hands of a doctor." "He shall be in a day or two," muttered Heathcliff. "But first, get up, Linton. Get up," he shouted. "Don't grovel on the ground there. Up this moment." Linton had sunk prostrate again in another paroxysm of helpless fear, caused by his father's glance towards him. I suppose there was nothing else to produce such humiliation. He made several efforts to obey, but his little strength was annihilated for the time, and he fell back again with a moan. Mr. Heathcliff advanced and lifted him to lean against a ridge of tuft. "Now," said he, with curbed ferocity, "I'm getting angry, and if you don't command the paltry spirit of yours, damn you, get up directly." "I will, father," he panted, "only let me alone or I shall faint. I've done as you wished, I'm sure. Catherine will tell you that I have been cheerful. Ah, keep by me, Catherine, give me your hand." "Take mine," said his father, "stand on your feet. There now, she'll lend you her arm. That's right, look at her. You would imagine I was the devil himself, Miss Linton, to excite such horror. Be so kind as to walk home with him, will you? He shudders if I touch him." "Linton, dear," whispered Catherine, "I can't go to Wuthering Heights. Papa has forbidden me. He'll not harm you. Why are you so afraid?" "I can never re-enter that house," he answered. "I'm not to re-enter it without you." "Stop," cried his father. "We'll respect Catherine's filial scruples. Nelly, take him in, and I'll follow your advice concerning the doctor without delay." "You'll do well," replied I, "but I must remain with my mistress. To mind your son is not my business." "You are very stiff," said Heathcliff. I know that, but you'll force me to pinch the baby and make it scream before it moves your charity. Come, then, my hero, are you willing to return, escorted by me?" He approached once more and made it as if he would seize the fragile being, but shrinking back, Linton clung to his cousin and implored her to accompany him. With a frantic importunity that admitted no denial, however, I disapproved. I couldn't hinder her. Indeed, how could she have refused him herself? What was filling him with dread, we had no means of discerning, but there he was, powerless under its gripe, and any addition seemed capable of shocking him into idiocy. We reached the threshold, Catherine walked in, and I stood waiting till she had conducted the invalid to a chair, expecting her out immediately, when Mr. Heathcliff, pushing me forward, exclaimed, "My house is not stricken with the plague, Nelly, and I have a mind to be hospitable today. Sit down and allow me to shut the door." He shut and locked it also. I started. "You shall have tea before you go home," he added. "I am by myself. Harriton is gone with some cattle to the Lees, and Zillah and Joseph are off on a journey of pleasure, and though I am used to being alone, I'd rather have some interesting company if I can get it. Miss Linton, take your seat by him. I give you what I have. The present is hardly worth accepting, but I have nothing else to offer. It is Linton, I mean." How she does stare. It's odd what a savage feeling I have to anything that seems afraid of me. Had I been born where laws are less strict and tastes less dainty, I should treat myself to a slow vivisection of those two as an evening's amusement. He drew in his breath, struck the table, and swore to himself, "By hell, I hate them." "I am not afraid of you," exclaimed Catherine, who could not hear the latter part of his speech. She stepped close up, her black eyes flashing with passion and resolution. "Give me that key, I will have it," she said. "I wouldn't eat or drink here if I was starving." Heathcliff had the key in his hand that remained on the table. He looked up, seized with a sort of surprise at her boldness, or possibly reminded by her voice and glance of the person from whom she inherited it. She snatched at the instrument and half succeeded in getting it out of his loosened fingers, but her action recalled him to the present. He recovered it speedily. "Now, Catherine Linton," he said, "stand off, or I shall knock you down, and that will make Mrs. Dean mad." Regardless of this warning, she captured his closed hand and its contents again. "We will go," she repeated, exerting her utmost efforts to cause the iron muscles to relax, and finding that her nails made no impression, she applied her teeth pretty sharply. Heathcliff glanced at me, a glance that kept me from interfering a moment. Catherine was too intent on his fingers to notice his fate. He opened them suddenly and resigned the object of dispute, but ere she had well secured it, he seized her with the liberated hand and, pulling her on his knee, administered with the other a shower of terrific slaps on both sides of the head, each sufficient to have fulfilled his threat, had she been able to fall. At this diabolical violence I rushed on him furiously. "You villain," I began to cry, "you villain." A touch on the chest silenced me. I am stout and soon put out of breath, and what with that and the rage, I staggered dizzily back and felt ready to suffocate or to burst a blood vessel. The scene was over in 2 minutes. Catherine released, put her two hands to her temples, and looked just as if she were not sure whether her ears were off or on. She trembled like a reed with the poor thing, and leant against the table perfectly bewildered. "I know how to chastise children, you see," said the scoundrel grimly, as he stooped to repossess himself of the key, which had dropped to the floor. "Go to Linton now, as I told you, and cry at your ease. I shall be your father tomorrow, all the father you'll have in a few days, and you shall have plenty of that. You can bear plenty. You're no weakling. You shall have a daily taste, if I catch such a devil of a temper in your eyes again." Cathy ran to me instead of Linton, and knelt down and put her burning cheek on my lap, weeping aloud. Her cousin had shrunk into a corner of the settle, as quiet as a mouse, congratulating himself, I dare say, that the correction had alighted on another than him. Mr. Heathcliff, perceiving us all confounded, rose and expeditiously made the tea himself. The cups and saucers were laid ready. He poured it out and handed me a cup. Wash away your spleen, he said, and help your own naughty pet and mine. It is not poisoned, though I prepared it. I'm going to seek your horses. Our first thought on his departure was to force an exit somewhere. We tried the kitchen door, but that was fastened outside. We looked at the windows. They were too narrow for even Cathy's little figure. Master Linton, I cried, seeing where we were regularly imprisoned. You know what your diabolical father is after, and you shall tell us, or I'll box your ears, as he has done your cousins. Yes, Linton, you must tell, said Catherine. It was for your sake I came, and it will be wickedly ungrateful if you refuse. Give me some tea, I'm thirsty, and then I will tell you, he answered. Mrs. Dean, go away. I don't like you standing over me. Now, Catherine, you are letting your tears fall into my cup. I won't drink that. Give me another. Catherine pushed another to him and wiped her face. I felt disgusted at the little wretch's composure, since he was no longer in terror for himself. The anguish he had exhibited on the moor subsided as soon as ever he entered Wuthering Heights, so I guessed he had been menaced with an awful visitation of wrath if he failed in decoying us there, and that accomplished, he had no further immediate fears. Papa wants us to be married, he continued, after sipping some of the liquid, and he knows your papa wouldn't let us marry now, and he's afraid of my dying if we wait, so we are to be married in the morning, and you are to stay here all night, and if you do as he wishes, you shall return home next day and take me with you. Take you with her, pitiful changeling, I exclaimed. You marry? Why, the man is mad, or he thinks us fools, everyone. And do you imagine that beautiful young lady, that healthy, hearty girl, will tie herself to a little perishing monkey like you? Are you cherishing the notion that anybody, let alone Miss Catherine Linton, would have you for a husband? You want whipping for bringing us in here at all, with your dastardly pulling tricks. And don't look so silly now. I have a very good mind to shake you severely for your contemptible treachery and your imbecile conceit. I did give him a slight shaking, but it brought on the cough, and he took to his ordinary resource of moaning and weeping, and Catherine rebuked me. Stay all night, no, she said, looking slowly around. Ellen, I'll burn that door down, but I'll get out. And she would have commenced the execution of her threat directly, but Linton was up in alarm for his dear self again. He clasped her in his two feeble arms, sobbing, Won't you have me and save me? Not let me come to the Grange, oh, darling Catherine, you mustn't go and leave after all. You must obey my father, you must. I must obey my own, she replied, and relieve him from this cruel suspense the whole night. What would he think? He'll be distressed already. I'll either break or burn away out of the house. Be quiet. You're in no danger, but if you hinder me, Linton, I love Papa better than you. The mortal terror he felt for Mr. Heathcliff's anger restored to the boy his coward's eloquence. Catherine was near distraught. Still, she persisted that she must go home, and tried entreaty in her turn, persuading him to subdue his selfish agony. While they were thus occupied, our jailer re-entered. "Your beasts have trotted off," he said, "and now, Linton, snivelling again, what has she been doing to you? Come, come, have done, and get to bed. In a month or two, my lad, you'll be able to pay her back her present tyrannies with a vigorous hand. You're pining for pure love, are you not? Nothing else in the world. And she shall have you. There, to bed. Zilla won't be here tonight. You must undress yourself. Hush, hold your noise. Once in your own room, I'll not come near you. You needn't fear. By chance, you've managed tolerably. I'll look to the rest." He spoke these words, holding the door open for his son to pass, and the latter achieved his exit exactly as a spaniel might have suspected the person who attended on it of designing a spiteful squeeze. The lock was re-secured. Heathcliff approached the fire, where my mistress and I stood silent. Catherine looked up and instinctively raised her hand to her cheek. His neighbourhood revived a painful sensation. Anybody else would have been incapable of regarding the childish act with sternness, but he scowled on her and muttered, "Oh, you are not afraid of me. Your courage is well disguised. You seem damnably afraid." "I am afraid now," she replied, "because if I stay, Papa will be miserable, and how can I endure making him miserable when he, Mr. Heathcliff, let me go home?" I promise to marry Linton. Papa would like me to, and I love him. Why should you wish to force me to do what I'm willingly do of myself? Let him dare to force you, I cried. There's a law in the land, thank God, there is. Though we be in an out-of-the-way place, I'd inform if he were my own son, and it's felony without benefit of clergy. Silence, said the ruffian. To the devil with your clamour. I don't want you to speak. Miss Linton, I shall enjoy myself remarkably in thinking your father will be miserable. I shall not sleep for satisfaction. You could have hit on no surer way of fixing your residence under my roof for the next 24 hours than informing me that such an event would follow. As to your promise to marry Linton, I'll take care you shall keep it, for you shall not quit this place till it is fulfilled. Send Alan, then, to let Papa know I'm safe, exclaimed Catherine, weeping bitterly. Or marry me now. Poor Papa. Alan, he'll think we're lost. What shall we do? Not he. He'll think you are tired of waiting on him, and run off for a little amusement, answered Heathcliff. You cannot deny that you entered my house of your own accord, in contempt of his injunctions to the contrary, and it is quite natural that you should desire amusement at your age, and that you would weary of nursing a sick man, and that man only your father. Catherine, his happiest days were over when your days began. He cursed you, I dare say, for coming into the world. I did, at least, and it would just do if he cursed you as he went out of it. I'd join him. I don't love you. How should I? Weep away. As far as I can see, it will be your chief diversion hereafter, unless Linton makes amends for other losses, and your provident parent appears to fancy he may. His letters of advice and consolation entertained me vastly. In his last he recommended my jewel to be careful of his, and kind to her when he got her. Careful and kind, that's paternal. But Linton requires his whole stock of care and kindness for himself. Linton can play the little tyrant well. He'll undertake to torture any number of cats if their teeth be drawn and their claws pared. You'll be able to tell his uncle fine tales of his kindness when you get home again, I assure you. You're right there, I said. Explain your son's character. Show his resemblance to yourself, and then I hope Miss Cathy will think twice before she takes the cockatrice. I don't much mind speaking of his amiable qualities now, he answered, because she must either accept him or remain a prisoner, and you along with her till your master dies. I can detain you both quite concealed here. If you doubt, encourage her to retract her word, and you'll have an opportunity of judging. I'll not retract my word, said Catherine. I'll marry him within this hour, if I may go to Thrushcross Grange afterwards. Mr. Heathcliff, you're a cruel man, but you're not a fiend, and you won't, from mere malice, destroy irrevocably all my happiness. If Papa thought I had left him on purpose, and if he died before I returned, could I bear to live? I've given over crying, but I'm going to kneel here at your knee, and I'll not get up, and I'll not take my eyes from your face till you look back at me. No, don't turn away. Do look. You'll see nothing to provoke you. I don't hate you. I'm not angry that you struck me. Have you never loved anybody in all your life, Uncle? Never? Ah, you must look once. I'm so wretched you can't help being sorry and pitying me. Keep your Eft's fingers off and move, or I'll kick you, cried Heathcliff, brutally repulsing her. I'd rather be hugged by a snake. How the devil can you dream of fawning on me? I detest you. He shrugged his shoulders, shook himself, indeed, as if his flesh crept with aversion, and thrust back his chair, while I got up and opened my mouth, and commenced a downright torrent of abuse. But I was rendered dumb in the middle of the first sentence by a threat that I should be shown into a room by myself the very next syllable I uttered. It was growing dark. We heard a sound of voices at the garden gate. Our host hurried out instantly. He had his wits about him, we had not. There was a talk of 2 or 3 minutes, and he returned alone. I thought it had been your cousin Harriton, I observed to Catherine. I wish he would arrive. Who knows but he might take our part. It was 3 servants sent to seek you from the Grange, said Heathcliff, overhearing me. You should have opened a lattice and called out, but I could swear that chit is glad you didn't. She's glad to be obliged to stay, I'm certain. At learning the chance we had missed, we both gave vent to our grief without control, and he allowed us to wail on till 9 o'clock. Then he bid us go upstairs through the kitchen to Zilla's chamber, and I whispered my companion to obey. Perhaps we might contrive to get through the window there, or into a garret and out by skylight. The window, however, was narrow, like those below, and the garret trap was safe from our attempts, for we were fastened in as before. We neither of us lay down. Catherine took her station by the lattice and watched anxiously for morning, a deep sigh being the only answer I could obtain to my frequent entreaties that she would try to rest. I seated myself in a chair and rocked to and fro, passing harsh judgment on my many derelictions of duty, from which it struck me then all the misfortunes of my employers sprang. It was not the case in reality, I am aware, but it was in my imagination that dismal night, and I thought Heathcliff himself less guilty than I. At 7 o'clock he came and inquired if Miss Linton had risen. She ran to the door immediately and answered, "Yes." "Here then," he said, opening it and pulling her out. I rose to follow, but he turned the lock again. I demanded my release. "Be patient," he replied. "I'll send up your breakfast in a while." I thumped on the panels and rattled the latch angrily, and Catherine asked why I was still shut up. He answered I must try to endure it another hour, and they went away. I endured it 2 or 3 hours. At length I heard a footstep, not Heathcliff's. "I've brought you something to eat," said a voice. "Open the door." Complying eagerly, I beheld Harriton, laden with food enough to last me all day. "Take it," he added, thrusting the tray into my hand. "Stay 1 minute," I began. "Nay," cried he, and retired, regardless of any prayers I could pour forth to detain him. And there I remained enclosed the whole day, and the whole of the next night, and another. 5 nights and 4 days I remained altogether, seeing nobody but Harriton once every morning, and he was a model of a jailer, surly and dumb and deaf to my every attempt to moving his sense of justice or compassion. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. And it turns out Heathcliff is a certified, bona fide psychopath. He has kidnapped and imprisoned both Nelly and Catherine. He's holding them hostage by threat of violence and demanding, blackmailing, and threatening them into a marriage, all the while denying Catherine from returning to see her father, who is on his deathbed. All because, 20 years ago, another guy got the girl. You know what, Heathcliff, in life, sometimes the other guy gets the girl. And you know what else? There's like a billion other girls out there. You just have to move on. It stings for a little while, man. But Jesus, man up a little bit. Sorry, but just take it on the chin, you know? Who, like, for such a big man, he is acting like a baby. You got your heart broken. It happens to everyone. It happens, dude. You don't have to freak out for 20 years. God, this book. I mean, it has stirred some passion in me, this passionate hate for Heathcliff. I now hate him with a passion. I already did, but this chapter, dear God, like, just arrest him. Just get the police involved or something, right? He's clearly gone beyond the law by this point. He's broken the law in several ways. Anyway, I don't know if I like this book or not. I mean, I do appreciate a book that can get me riled up about a character and to inspire me to hate a character. That's a sign of good writing. When you hate them, not because it's bad writing, but because the character is terrible. But I don't know. This is not a fun read. This is not pleasant. And what the hell is wrong with the readers out there? Those of you out there that read this as a love story, you need some serious therapy. because this is anything but a love story. Dear. All right. Anyway, rant over. Have your say about this chapter. It's probably more interesting than mine. Over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. I look forward to reading your thoughts. Thanks for listening today, and I'll see you tomorrow.